Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. This is a recording from the monthly Oldie Literary Lunch at the National Liberal Club. To book a ticket, please go to www.theoldie.co.uk/lunches.
We've got three terrific speakers here today. Our first is one of our most distinguished biographers. Lucy Moore has written biographies of Nijinsky, Anything Goes, a biography of the Roaring Twenties, and her new book is about the distinguished aesthete and interior designer Christopher Gibbs, and it's called Christopher Gibbs, His World by Lucy Moore.
Thank you very much, Harry. Thank you, the Oldie, for having me, and thank you all so much for coming. It's really lovely to be here. So, I'm here to talk about Christopher Gibbs. I don't know if any of you remember him, but he was the original influencer back in the 60s. Nowadays, I think influencers want to be influencers, but in Christopher's day, he was an influencer because people wanted to be like him. He was mostly an antiques dealer, but he also was a decorator. And in the 60s, he was a bit of a god. He lived in Cheyne Walk. His flat was used in Performance and in Antonini's Blow Up. He had an amazing antique shop in Elliston Street. Charismatic and effortlessly cool, he was reputedly the first man to wear flares, the first man in London to have long hair. Friend and advisor to the Stones, Mick Jagger especially, and he's often spotted sort of lurking in the background of things like the Redland bust photos. He was born in 1938 one of the things that was special about him, I think, was this lovely sense of security and confidence he had. He was completely unworried about what other people thought of him, and he had a great sense of material security because he was born into an establishment family. The joke went with the Gibbses that Mr. Gibbs had got his dibs by selling the turds of foreign birds. the Gibbses had made their money in the 19th century from guano. So Christopher had a sort of material comfort behind him, but he also had a very warm and affectionate family. He was the youngest of, he was the fifth of six, but he was born at a time when your mother, she had four sons and she was having her fifth baby. Christopher was born, and then the doctor said, hang on a minute, there's another one here, and his twin sister was born. So he had this wonderful kind of loving and very affectionate upbringing, which I think gave him a lot of confidence. He was also, and it was a kind of family where, I mean, he was gay, obviously at a time when it was illegal to be gay, but within his family, nobody was fussed at all. It was something very, you know, everybody understood and accepted. It was not a... So he sort of didn't have any of that kind of angst that people sometimes have. His mother set Christopher up in his first shop in 1958 when he was 20. Within 7 years, he'd sold his first piece to the V&A, and that started a path, part of his career, which was very much involved with those great institutions like the V&A, the National Trust. He was very involved in the restoration of Spencer House, and he engineered a huge donation to the National Gallery in the 80s, but from his friend Paul Getty. So, and the Diocesan Advisory Committee for the Care of Churches was very close to his heart. So he had this this very public-spirited sense as well as kind of making money from antiques. The reason that I wrote the book about him is from a personal level because my husband is his nephew, and so when he died, I came across all these articles that he'd written. So he'd written, I'd always known about his writing for World of Interiors, but he'd started writing for Vogue in the 60s. He was its wine correspondent. He was the man who wrote the shopping pages for Men in Vogue. He's just got the most wonderful, rather florid turn of phrase. And the book is a lot of pictures, but also a lot of his articles. He then moved on to World of Interiors. I'm just going to do a quick quote from Min Hogg, who was his great friend who founded World of Interiors. "Chrissy even knows the provenance of a pebble. Taste is impossible to define, but his is absolute perfection. He has an encyclopedic knowledge of sales and catalogues, but I love that he can also be entranced by the beauty of a simple glass cabinet full of nothing in particular. So what he also had, and which I hope the book shows, is a real gift for friendship. He had this great friend, Peter Hinwood, who was Rocky in the Rocky Horror Picture Show, the guy in the gold pants. They were, great friends for decades. But he was also friends with Bruce Chatwin, Cecil Beaton, this great list of amazing figures from the age. David and Martha Milinarik, John Michel, John Harris, the great architectural historians. So I'm going to read quickly John Harris on Christopher, and then I'm going to read a little article by Christopher, just to give you a sense of his book. So this is John Harris in 2000, in the year that Christopher sold the contents of his Oxfordshire house and there was a huge Christie's sale. If Christopher has adopted any personal theory of interior decoration, it is that rare attribute of anchoring the house, not only to its beginnings, but in order to retain the sense of continuous generations of occupancy. What we see are layers of history. At Clifton Hampden, which is the house, he will point out provenances, an Arundel marble, John Evelyn's table from Wootton, books from the great Syston Library, the coat of the Sherwood Forester from Rufford Abbey, the portrait of Lord Coningsby's fool, the rarity of the pocketbook of Lord Yarmouth, he of that Yarmouth treasure painting in the Norwich Castle Museum, linen fold panelling from Peterhouse, the amazing wooden figure from Waterstock, or a Celtic altar from Beeston. There is no accumulation like it. There is also one other attribute that has often escaped comment. I mean his delight in the overall effect of subdued colour, produced by exotic carpets, wall hangings, rare fabrics, stained glass, and above all by the fact that the interiors are a kingdom of flowers, to quote Horace Walpole's description of Dickie Bateman's house. The whole is a wondrous kaleidoscope. And that makes me think of his childhood nickname. He was always known as Blossom, because he was always picking bunches of flowers and bringing them inside. So that's back to John Harris. Now, although Christopher could have been one of the great decorators of his time, he's never wanted this role, preferring to be the supplier, and in so doing, be also the eminence grise, the impresario, or the mentor to these friends and decorators fortunate enough to buy from him. The casual, artless look that he is able so persuasively to adopt is difficult to locate as to origins. I don't think it can be identified in the earlier history of decoration. He's no bookworm to historic precedents. His style is a modern phenomenon, and Christopher may have been the first to have adopted it. It involves a certain romantic aesthetic. So that's John Harris on Christopher. And then I'm going to just read, if I've got time, a short article which wasn't published. I found this in the file of Vogue articles, but I don't think it was ever published, I think because it was too rude. It's a review of David Hicks's book, classic book, on decoration in 1967. Most people need advice, and most people have no idea how dowdy their lives and living quarters are. Mr. David Hicks, has written an excellent book to wise them up. He believes in architecture, comfort, good lighting, bold, clean colours, abhors standard lamps, wall-to-wall Wilton carpet, the skimpy and the spurious. Of course he is right, and of course most people need to have the 1001 wise maxims he makes written down for them and made palatable by fascinating digressions on Countess Boule de Breteuil's poison garden in Marrakesh, or Baroness Philippe de Rothschild wrestling with a red cabbage on a pink linen tablecloth. To divulge your credo to your public is courageous and commendable, and I hope a lot of people will buy and read this book, but it is also to lay yourself open to attack. I find Mr. Hicks's concept of taste a trifle rigid for 1967. People need not shrink from wholesome vulgarity as if it were the Gorgon's head, or from abandoned disorder. Gracious living is on the skids. Pads will be warm, fragrant, wired for sound. Every room will be for eating, sleeping, and swinging. Decorations will be worn night and day. Though Mr. Hicks is currently the most influential voice in English decoration, there is no slacking among his rivals. While he is in Palm Beach waving his magician staff at Mrs. Michael Phipps, Mrs. Paul Mellon is growing black flowers and massing just her late bonnards on a tiny Tuile de Joie staircase. Mr. Fowler is distressing a Whig palace in the Shires. Mr. Felix Harbord leaps from island to island, leaving here a silver cavern hung with certs for Count Bismarck, there a ravishing villa in the form of a fan. In Scotland, Mrs. Elwes is whipping electricity out in candlelight into Mr. Keith Schellenberg's castle dining room and making bachelor's bedrooms approached by silken rope ladders through manholes in the ceiling. David Milinarik is painting a studio in seven shades of snow white for young Mr. Alan Claw, and the skyline at Longleat will soon be abristle with regimented busts of contemporary worthies from the midnight chisel of Manu Hornack. Michael Raymond is building a dream palace for EMI's Sir Joe Lockwood, and John Wright and Jean Schofield are thinking a lot more about Charles Rennie Mackintosh. Decoration could become a bizarre form of insulation against art. It has no prophets, no visionaries. Too many decorators have forgotten or never heard of Jean-Michel Franck and Madame Erazuriz, and now find themselves in a sterile no-man's land where painting and sculpture are merely modishly lit objects, colours can't sing, and furniture dies as soon as it is shifted from its immediate context. Breathtaking chic is a stifling loser scene, and don't ever forget it. So that's Christopher on style for a man who was very good claim to be, you know, about the most chic man there was. He didn't think much of it, really, and that is kind of part of his charm. And it's very nice to stand up and recommend a book that I have purely put together and not written myself, because it's always awkward to stand up and say, please buy and read my book. I can wholeheartedly say you will love Christopher's book, because he was such an original. That's it. Thank you very much for having me.
You have been listening to Radio Aldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Aldie magazine for just £1? Sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.